one was really important to me because, one, I think I really learned about my boundaries. I think one of the challenges when you're working in impact, really strong mission-led organizations, is that leaders in that space can tend to, especially when your employees are young and just really excited, you know, really pull and tug on, you know, work hard, because the harder you work, the harder you work, the reflection of your connectedness to the mission is articulated. Like, the more you work, the more you believe in the mission. And of course, when the mission's an amazing thing, it's like, of course I want to do more. Of course I want to, like, make sure that the best work comes forward. And so you're willing to go so many miles beyond what anyone would otherwise work.
I'm Diana, certified career strategist, leadership and sales coach with 10 plus years of experience helping high performing teams and individuals figure out their careers. Welcome to the Spotlight Project, where we'll be listening to a one-time, raw and unfiltered career conversation of everyday people willing to share their stories. This podcast is being recorded on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Spotlight Project. My name is Diana, your host, and this podcast is all about spotlighting people's unique career stories. Today, I'm really excited because I get to kiki with one of my best friends. I feel like this podcast is really just about recording my best friends, but today's guest is Cecilia Christosimo, real life BFF and head of success at a non-for-profit in Toronto. Hi, Cece.
Hello, the facts are wrong.
The facts are correct. What is incorrect?
We are for profit.
Okay, sorry. Well, you get to do your own intro in a second, so you can correct the introduction. I swear I did research. All right, Cecilia, do you want to introduce yourself, your name, your pronouns, and what it is you do today in your job position?
Yes, so my name is Cecilia Chrysostomo. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. Yeah, so I am the head of success at a for-profit B Corp called Too Good To Go that just launched in Canada, but has been in Europe for the past 5 years.
Yes, for-profit, for-profit.
For-profit B Corp, yeah.
What does, I mean, we'll get into this, but what does Too Good To Go do? What's the mission?
Yeah, so essentially we envision a world where there's no food waste. And so what we've done is we've created a marketplace where any business with surplus food is able to put that food up on the marketplace, which is an app. And everyday consumers like yourself and myself can download the app and purchase food that is past its prime or going to hit the bin unless folks like us save it from the food bin. So you can purchase the food at about a third of the price, all with the intention of reducing the amount of food waste that goes into landfill.
I think it's very relevant considering the climate we've had lately. So I'm excited to dig into that with you. Also, she rehearsed.
That was a pitch. Remember that key messaging we did early on in our lives?
So it happens in sales, baby. You learn elevator pitches like no tomorrow. That was actually really great. I thought that was explained super clearly. Cece, before we get into your, you know, how you landed at as head of success is Too Good To Go and a little bit more about that. I mean, that's very recent in your career. I want to do a little bit of something different with you than I've done in the other interviews, because I've gone straight into what do you do? What's your job? What's your career? But with you, I kind of want to meet the person before I meet your job, because I think a lot of your background and your upbringing probably, I'm making an assumption here, but probably has influenced a lot of your career leaps and your career choices. So can we start here? Can you talk a little bit about your upbringing? And you don't have to go through like when you were born and all that crazy detail, but just generally, like when someone asks you, what was your upbringing like? What do you remember about that time period? What do you usually tell people?
was the summer of 1988.
Oh, is this about to turn into a song?
Two immigrants landed from the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
But really, my story, how it started. Yes, I am such a product of my parents. So it'd be remiss to not explain who they are and then sort of who I am. So my parents, my dad at the time was studying his second MBA. So A, a numbers guy, B, very ambitious, but incredibly humble as a human being. He was in Belgium and he was looking to immigrate from the Philippines. My mom had a lot of family in the US, so that was sort of a natural place to go. I say this story jokingly, but like at the time in the 80s, there was way more immigration going to the US than to Canada. And it was harder from Belgium for my dad to go to the US than it was to Canada. I make the joke that he was going to the embassy during his lunch break between classes, and that lineup was much longer in the US than it was to Canada. So we ended up going to Canada because he had a short lunch break. But I'm pretty sure I made that up. But it seems romantic, so I keep telling it.
It's just a great story. It just makes sense. You visualize this Filipino man seeing two lines ahead of him and choosing the one
less traveled. Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we had family in the US, but none in Canada. So, yeah, my dad came to Canada first. He came in March. He landed in Vancouver and sort of set up shop in very typical Filipino sort of immigrant story where he didn't have a lot of money, but he found a job, lived right at the corner of, or like right up the beach from Sunset Beach, or what is that? Sunnyside Beach?
Sunset. Oh, you're the one on the west side of Vancouver?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
We walked there. I don't know.
He's at a beach.
Davies and Brard area, you know, right. Okay. Downtown.
Yep.
Got a job at a 7-Eleven with two MBAs. Mm-hmm. And my mom came 3 or 4 months after in July. And she flew from the Philippines when she was far too pregnant to be able to. Again, this is a romantic story that I say, but I say that she came over just so in time so I could like be born in Canada, be a citizen, and secure their citizenship here in Canada. Again, did I make that up? Unclear.
I feel like your parents are very, their choices were very strategic.
Right?
Yeah.
Very thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was, my mom landed, I think, at the end of June, and I was born in July. So, yeah, born in Vancouver, raised in Toronto.
Right. So why... Well, I guess here's my question. When you say that out loud and tell your upbringing out loud like that, what do you pull from that story in terms of how your career has played out over the last, whatever, 12 years you've been working?
Yeah, I think when I think about the choices my parents made, just always in terms of building the best life, for their future. And that I think is like something that I think about and I think is very much ingrained in me, and the decisions that I make is what are the decisions that I'm making now that are better for the future. And then the second thing is just how family oriented we are, just like the focus on building for future generations and your family specifically. And I think when I think about wherever we moved to as a family, it was always about creating a family unit. Regardless of if we're actually related, it's a chosen family that we created so strongly. So I think about that. And I also just think about like sort of that mentality of like one foot after the other. You just got to do the work. And that is something that I take from both my parents, just in terms of like, do the work, be humble about it, but don't stop being ambitious about it.
Mm.
And that I think when I think about how I tell that story or why I tell that story is because I think about all the privilege that I hold today, and not, and it's not coming from a place of, it's coming from a place of being aware that there was work before me, you know?
Yeah, that the struggle to have the privilege you have today existed, right?
Yeah, and it's funny. I don't love to use the word struggle.
Okay.
Because it depicts this, like, yes, it's like it's work, and like struggle to me sounds like fighting against a force, but to me it's just work, you know. And I think we oftentimes forget that, like, work is part of life, you know. It's a thing that we all have to do, you know. We all have to contribute, and like work is to me is just work, you know.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I think that's an interesting way to put it. I didn't think about it like that before. So that's interesting. So you talk, I mean, what I hear you say in there is this idea of a commune and community building a future for yourself, your family, and just recognizing that work is work, right? Okay. So how does this all play into how you first started on this path in your career? Because I know you're working for profit now, I was corrected, but your entire career up to this point has been nonprofit, right? So We Charity, Jack.org, I mean, very mission purpose driven organizations that are doing good work. So how do you think all of that from your upbringing got you started on like not-for-profit and travel and all that kind of stuff? Or were you just looking for a job at a university? It could be that too. It doesn't have to be that deep sometimes.
Honestly, yeah, I think that whole purpose piece has definitely been something that's developed over time. Yeah, I was a kid coming back to Toronto from university and just kind of unclear of where I wanted to go.
Because you studied biology, right? Like, was there a reason you studied biology, or is just that I'm going to pick biology and...
Because I loved science. I love, and this is where biology comes into play in terms of like always having done sort of operationally focused work, or at least that's where I've led my career. Is like, I love thinking about things as ecosystems and like how things interact with one another, and like the idea of like symbiosis and, you know, parasitic relationships and things like that. So everything
oh my God.
To me is like everything that happens in this world can be reflected back to you in nature. And so you don't have to look far to really understand patterns or the way things work. Nature gives that to you. So that to me is like my interest in bio. If I really think now, like years later, I probably should have gone into economics because of my love for math. And to me, it's like human society mixed with math is econ, but you know, hindsight's 2020. What was the question again?
Sorry, I digress this into your biology background, and then you got really passionate sharing biology terminology into business. The question was how all that played out into your early choices to work in nonprofit for the bulk of your career.
Yeah, I think at the heart of it, I always wanted to do something that mattered to people. I went into educational travel because my first job at a university was educational travel. The reason I went into it was because I had seen the impact of travel as a young person. I think, you know, something that I'm so grateful for to my parents is that growing up, we never felt far from the Philippines. They worked really hard to be able to send us to the Philippines more or less every summer and feel connected to our family there, to our culture there. And I think just knowing how much that perspective of being a Filipino, seeing the Philippines, seeing the diversity of life there, what life there could be like in contrast to the life I lived in Canada, that was never lost on me. Seeing abject poverty right in your face, but never calling it something other from who I am and part of the identity that I hold. I just knew how much travel provided me with a wider breadth of humanity. And so educational travel was that thing for me where it was like, if I can be a part of this and provide young people with the opportunity to travel, then that to me is a reflection of doing something that matters to people. Mm. And so did that for a hot second, and then went over to meet a wee because I knew one of the facilitators, Andrea McFedrin, was the one that introduced me to Wii. She was like, we're starting a sales team. Interested?
Yeah. Come? I said,
come?
Come?
I said, okay. Then I interviewed and I got the job and then I was there.
And then 9 years later is when you left. Okay. I want to spend a lot of time talking about your experiences at Wii.
Yeah.
Because, for a couple of reasons. One, 9 years at a place nowadays is unprecedented. So I want to talk about what kept you there for as long as it did. And then secondly, when you look at we'll just call them, for lack of a better word, titles that you held when you were there, you're kind of a jack of all trades. You didn't really stay in one role longer than a couple of years. You were in ops, you were in partnerships and sponsorships, you were in sales. My assumption is you got to see the breadth and the scope of how this organization operated. And so I want to hear about that too. So can we start with the breadth and the scope and what you learned just from a business perspective first?
Yeah. I mean, there are many folks who will knock Wii for many various reasons. And I think that is a conversation for another day. But what I will defend to the end is the exposure that it gave us as employees, especially those of us who started sort of around the time when Wii was really taking off, was just exposure to responsibilities, exposure to other businesses, exposure to really talented thinkers. And for that, I will forever be grateful to Wii. I don't think I would have gotten the exposure, the responsibility, the space to make mistakes, to show up authentically. I don't think I could have done that and had that kind of growth anywhere else. That's my experience at Wii. And so for all its flaws or all of the challenges that they faced, I think Wii provided me with so much room to grow. Challenges that I think, had I not faced them, it would not be who I am today. So, you know, for better, for worse, you know, you sort of take the experience, and if you're someone that can really be reflective and pull out the best of a circumstance, it's an incredible experience. And so that's really what kept me, was this constant space of growth, of being a safe place to test out how to manage, how to approach a challenge, how to have challenging conversations, all those things, because I was trusted with so much responsibility early on in my life. Mm. So I think, you know, yes, that tenure is really long at one place, but to your point, like, I was constantly changing and evolving, and that was something that early on I definitely had to learn to advocate for myself for, and I'm thankful that I had that lesson to learn of how to advocate for myself. But two, once I really had a trusted position within the organization, had really the room to grow every function that I had into something that I really was proud to do by the end of it.
That makes a ton of sense. I mean, on the outside looking in, the 9 years seems like a long time, but also we're an impatient generation. We're told mm-hmm. to leap roles every 2 to 3 years. But that makes sense to me, hearing you put it that way, is if you're constantly evolving, if you're constantly feeling challenged, if you're still feeling connected to the work, then yeah, why wouldn't you stay? That makes a ton of sense. I do want to talk a little bit about what pushed you out the door though, and eventually, and also a little bit about some of those leaps, but I'm going to put a pin in that for a second, because I want to talk about your learnings and insights in nonprofit. And so what I mean by that is, because I've worked in nonprofit, I worked at Wii with you, there's all the good stuff. Like, you do good things for humanity, you provide these trips and students come home transformed. But the flip side of that and we got this on the phone a lot, is, are you actually doing good work? Is it truly sustainable? Is this just some sort of colonistic model where you're sending white people into colored or minority communities just to say you're doing good work? And I'm saying this directly because this is how it came to us, right? What's your face right now? What's your perspective or opinion on this being ingrained on the inside of an organization like this? I know I went there, but I think it's interesting.
Yeah. This is a tough one for me to answer, I think. I do believe in young people traveling. Like I'll defend that till forever. But I think the intention has to be clear. And the intention has to be, the intention has to be clear in terms of the outcomes of that travel. And it also, I think, has to come from a space that, let's be honest, both sides, the intention is that the travelers are the beneficiary of the experience. First and foremost, you as a traveler are the person that is exposed to something that you wouldn't otherwise see. That is your perspective that is being grown, that it is, it is your life that is going to be changed. That to me is the important, that is the leading takeaway from this experience. The moment that the conversation becomes you are benefiting someone else by your presence being there, that's quite assumptive. And in that fashion, I think that's where you start to have this idea of, folks from the West and Western values being superior to those outside. And this is such a small reframing, but one I think that is so important is that the people that are benefiting are the travelers. You are the ones that are going to be educated about a different way of life, and your perspective is going to be shifted. If by chance this opens up some really great opportunities for local communities, amazing. But let's not kid ourselves as who's the primary beneficiary. And so in that sense, I think when you think of the power dynamic between travelers and locals, that balance needs to be very clear as to, who plays what role and what's the dynamic between the two. Not to say that travelers can't make a positive impact, right? But let's again be very clear on who is the primary beneficiary of impact on this trip.
I think I loved that way that you've said that. I think that's a really important articulation of the purpose of volunteerism, or the purpose of taking young people overseas to some of these local communities, is that intention and who is the beneficiary. And I think that's why you and I connected so much to the mission at We and believed in the work that we did, because I think that intention was fairly clear for the most part. But yeah, so thank you for going there with me. I know it's an uncomfortable space sometimes, but I wanted to go there because I think it's important for people to hear from someone like you who's been on both sides of it, as to what your perspective is on something like that. And then we don't have a solution, and it's complicated, and there's a lot of variables, but I wanted to go there with you. So thanks for that.
Yeah.
We can move out of this uncomfortable zone.
We can stay in it if you want.
We'll go back. Don't you worry. Can we go more on the career side of you? Because we got a little existential and philosophical there. But you talked about some of those, we'll call them micro leaps. Some of them are macro leaps within We. Can you talk about some of the more profound ones that really stuck with you when you were either switching gears, jobs, managing people? Which one has carried with you?
Yeah. Oof. So one, in terms of transitions, was my first attempt to leave WE.
Your first of many attempts. How many attempts were there?
Real attempts, not many, but like, yeah. I mean, who doesn't have days where they're like, oh, I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
But this one was really important to me because one, I think I really learned about my boundaries. I think one of the challenges when you're working in impact, really strong mission-led organizations is that leaders in that space can tend to, especially when your employees are young and just really excited, you know, really pull and tug on, you know, work hard, because the harder you work, the harder you work, the reflection of your connectedness to the mission is articulated. Like, the more you work, the more you believe in the mission. And of course, when the mission's an amazing thing, it's like, of course I want to do more. Of course I want to like make sure that the best work comes forward. And so you're willing to go so many miles beyond what anyone would otherwise work. You know, if you weren't connected to the work, chances are you'd easily clock out at 5 o'clock. But like, when you're mission driven and the work that you do means something to you personally, it's easy for you to get lost in just continuing to do the work. But also when you're young, you're like, well, yeah, of course I want to do a ton of work because I believe in the impact that I'm making. And so for me, that exit or like attempt to exit was really important because I learned where my boundaries were. I think I left because I was burnt out. I know I left because I was burnt out. I knew I was burnt out because I literally was sitting on a call with a potential client, a potential traveler, and I was mindlessly, like not even consciously, going through the exit forms, and I had resigned while like just so passively. And I think like my subconscious was just like, it's time to go. Because I was just so exhausted. I wasn't inspired. I wasn't motivated by the team. I think at the time, so many folks were moving on from the organization. And I felt like I had tapped out in terms of how I could really meaningfully contribute beyond just volume. For me, what I learned was that I wanted to grow, but growth meant something specific. It didn't just mean growing your capacity and taking on more work. It meant being challenged a certain way. And so for me, that was an important, at least attempt at an exit, because I learned like I do have a boundary. I know what it meant for me to be inspired by work every day and to show up, but also where the boundary lies in terms of taking care of myself and my personal needs. And how to have those conversations constructively before you hit burnout, as opposed to like being burnt out and your body telling you, get out.
Yeah. How do you pay attention to the tell signs a little earlier? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about the false stop? So, because I think that's interesting. So eventually your subconscious was like, girl, you're tired. Time to move on.
She's tired.
But also, because I mean, you and I being good friends, I was a part of a lot of those false start conversations. And I know part of it is you still felt like there was work to be done. You were still feeling challenged, which I think is fair. Mm-hmm. But what else do you think drove some of those false starts?
Yeah, I think something that I'm gonna blame this part of my identity, but I hate to do it. But I think as a female and as a woman of color, particularly Asian, you're often taught to sort of just like put your head down and do it, you know? And so the moment that you recognize that your needs are out of whack, it's almost like the responsibility is on you to address your needs, as opposed to advocating for yourself and saying to your boss, like, hey, I need some time, or hey, I need this type of support or learning. Like, I'm not quick to ask for help. I'm quick to say, cool, what do I need to do or learn or figure out on my own spare time so that I could show up and do the work. And so for me, during those like attempted exit or like those moments where I was like, I think I'm done, I think it was that one, I didn't know how to advocate for myself or feel confident enough to do it. And B, when I did have those opportunities to say what I needed, I was always given like a light at the end of the tunnel. And so I think something that I take from my parents is just like the level of resilience that they have. And so like, I do know, and especially going through COVID and just how I've been able to manage my work life particularly, I do recognize that I'm quite a resilient individual. And so for better or for worse, I think it has its dark sides as well. I'm quite resilient to sort of wading through pretty tough, like working situations, if you will.
I wanted to ask you this question because I think, so this idea of resiliency, but especially for Asian women, I'm not saying all Asian women, but I share this sentiment with you, is that I think the dark side of that resiliency is we will sort of muster through and show up and continue to be reliable, even though it pushes beyond our boundaries or creates exhaustion. I think it's very common and conditioned in Asian women to do that. I think on the other side too, for in terms of advocating for what you need and what you want, it sort of then shatters that illusion of resiliency and dependability, right? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I know for me, that's always a difficult part. It's like, I don't want this person or this boss to think that I can't hack it, or I can't handle the volume, or that I'm not competent, or like, I'm not willing to show up. It's like none of those things. Mm-hmm. It's just, I'm at capacity, but mm-hmm. It's really hard for us to say so, especially when you work so hard to get to the certain positions you end up landing into. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm again, don't let me put words in your mouth, but do you share that thought, or was it a little different for you?
Yes, I always am avoiding the moment when someone thinks I can't hack it.
Yes.
I never want someone to think that I can't hack it.
No.
I think I've built my identity on being the person, like, if there's shit hitting the fan, this is who you want in your corner. And I take that with pride. So yeah, like there's never a day that I show up to work where I never want someone to think I'm incompetent or unable or can't like blow expectations out of the water.
Mm,
totally. That's not my brand. Like truly not my brand.
Yeah. I mean, we're best friends, so I feel you on this. I share this a lot. Also too, on the flip side, when, I don't know if you feel this, but when someone thinks that you can't do it, or you're not capable, for me, it's a huge activator. Fuck
that's
you.
A not today, Satan.
No, not today, Satan. Buckle that seatbelt. I'm about to show you.
Let me get back to you in 20 minutes and I'll turn that around for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the contributor to leader leap? Because this is one I hear a lot. For women of color, but just generally.
Yeah.
When you go from being peers mm-hmm. with your team to then being their manager and then being new to management and not knowing what the fuck you're doing, what was that experience like for you?
I think I'm still figuring that out. I call myself a forever coordinator. Like I never, and I like sort of jokingly, but very like, I don't mean to say it facetiously. Like I really take that to heart, because I think the thing when you have that mentality of constantly being entry level, it's like, stay humble, do the work. Like I never want my team to think that I can't like hop in with them and be in the trenches with them. And so to me, it's important as a leader that like I do the work, and that it's people see that the work is done. If they have to call 100 people a day, I'm in there calling 110. I am a firm believer that like leaders need to lead with action and lead by example. I don't believe in asking people to do things that I myself wouldn't do. And so I say that I'm forever coordinator because to me, like, it keeps me humble. It keeps me close to understanding when I make decisions as a leader that this is going to impact someone else's day to day. And so if I make a decision to not hire someone, or I change the ratio of a number of accounts to a person, that those decisions impact how people see themselves, how they see success, how they show up to work, the attitudes that they have, the types of relationships that they have with their clients. Those decisions that I make impact their work. And so if I don't understand their work, how can I make that decision responsibly?
I totally agree. Mm-hmm.
And so I like to think like my job as the head of success, I need to be the best like coordinator, entry-level person that like on the team, or at least very capable, like a strong, like it's just a really be able to do that job competently. I hope I hire people who can do the job way better than me. And I think that was the learning for me going from an individual contributor to a manager or whatever leader, is to start learning to identify people who really just learn really well and can do the work better than you can, because that helps you free up the space for you to make decisions, but make it from a place of knowing the impact that it has on your team. So that's, I think, that was the learning for me going from an individual contributor, is like, yes, I should be able to, but I'm also in a position to make decisions that are best for the team, that is best for the impact and the outcome. What I've learned is that I'm really good at seeing the big picture, and zooming in and zooming out. And that talent is something that I need to have the room to do. So it's important to delegate the day-to-day tasks to other folks. And so it was really understanding, it was also getting comfortable with delegating. Like that, I think, is a tough, as an individual contributor, like that is a tough one when your identity is so built upon the output and the quality of output or the volume of output that you know you can make, and then all of a sudden you're not. It's kind of like, what is the job of a manager? What, like, how do you value communicating down and communicating up? You know, for me, that was always like that middle management role was always kind of like, what value is this actually providing?
It's hard because it's not as measurable when you're in a contributor seat anymore. Yeah. Like, well, you say a couple of interesting things there, but for me, it what it triggers is it's a whole nother level of trust game when you're used to controlling the output, being the only one responsible for your success and for the numbers and the goals. I say this is more of a sales position, but it's relevant for everything. Mm-hmm. To now being responsible for other people to be successful in order for you to be successful. So I think that's why the delegation is difficult, because it requires a different level of trust. It's like, I just got to trust that you're going to get it done and get it done to the quality that you need to, because I need to be able to zoom in and out. But it's hard. It's really hard to do that when you've been able to control your output this whole time.
Yeah. And when you hold yourself to like quite a high standard.
Yes. Yeah.
And you also feel a sort of level of guilt around holding other people to that standard, because it's like, it's fine for me to hold that standard, but is it fair for me to put that on someone else?
That's where you and I are different leadership style wise. I'm like, my standard is here.
Totally.
You're going to come up here. That's what's about to happen. But I know what you mean, though. I know what you mean. What's something, I want to stay on this manager topic just for a second more, but what's something you wish you did differently now in hindsight, like 8 years managing people versus when you first started? What would you have done differently?
You know, I wish I learned team design earlier on.
Like how to build a team, you mean?
Or just like hired more proactively, I think, especially in like the charity space. Like you're often, it's like if the funding is there, then hire someone. But it's like chances are you probably needed that person 6 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. And I'm excited. And this to me is just the relief that I feel in working for a for-profit space is that I feel empowered to make decisions that are smarter for us in the long run, to bring someone on quite early, but allow them to scale up their ability with the portfolio that they're going to take on, with the work that's going to come scale with the company as we grow. But I feel empowered to do that. I don't feel like I have to ask for help after I've already exhausted myself. It's that I get to make decisions that are proactive rather than reactive.
So is that the lesson there for you? If you were to look back at your junior manager self, to make more proactive than reactive decisions?
Yeah. And just be more, more confident with knowing that, like, you know, that it's okay to advocate for more help, for more like capacity. You know, I think like I'm already quite an efficient, an efficiency seeking person. And so asking for more like human capacity isn't a reflection of an inability to do work effectively or efficiently. That it is simply just the capacity that that's needed.
Well, it's interesting that you said the word more. That's actually what I picked up, is to ask for more. I don't think it's more. I think it's what you need.
It's just the appropriate amount.
The appropriate amount to do what you need to do as a team. So in a revenue driving team, if your goal is to hit 36 million in revenue that year, but you only have 3 account executives, you need bodies. Mm-hmm. I need 6 more people because that's what I need in order to deliver. It sounds so simple, but it's difficult to ask for when you're a new manager, because you also, part of you doesn't know sometimes either, right?
Yeah, it's also hard to tie, it's hard to tie your needs to someone else's ability to deliver it for you.
Yeah.
I had this interesting conversation this week, and this is just so new to me, but we call them care conversations, and they're just conversations straight up about what you as a person need. And more, you can ask me about projections, you can ask me about what the process is, but if you ask me what I need personally, that is a hard conversation. I literally walked into my boss and was like, I'm good. I'm low maintenance. I'm good. Thank you. My needs are met. Great. We're done the conversation. Thank you. But it's, I think just like identity wise, like that's just always like how you're raised. You're raised not to need something. You're raised not to ask for more than what you have, and what you have is enough. And so whether it's yourself personally, or it's work or whatever, it's like, you don't need anything. You've got what you need. You need to make that work. So being able to ask for things, like asking for a notebook at work was quite challenging and is still a challenge to this day.
Now, as the head of success at Too Good To Go, you're a head of success, which is something, we'll call it in quotations, formal titles you haven't really done before. So how's it been, you know, jumping into, I'm assuming, big shoes, big scope, in a success job that you may not have necessarily done formally on paper? Like, how has that been?
Yeah. Honestly, I don't think I've ever felt more empowered in a role than I have here. And that's much to do with the culture of the organization, but also I think the leadership team that I'm so humbly grateful to work with. I am not one for titles. I'm not one for, you know, seeing success and then all of a sudden a flurry of other folks who work in success reaching out and being like, let's jam out. To me, like, I love to hire folks that don't necessarily have the title, but have the way of thinking. And so for me, I would much rather hire someone that has a certain mindset, a certain perspective or way of approaching challenges than to hire someone that has worked in success for the last 10 years. You know, if you're looking to innovate and be different, why hire someone that has done that? You know, so for me, success here is about optimizing the amount of meals that are saved, optimizing the supply and making sure that our stores put as much of their food waste on our platform as possible, optimizing our users going to stores and purchasing surprise bags as much as possible. That optimizing can happen in so many different ways and shapes and forms. And happens in any role, right? Like it's a mindset and it's a way of approaching a problem. And so I've done that. I've done that for years. I've looked at how do we optimize our pipeline in sales? How do we optimize this call list? Rather than calling every single person, can I target someone in a more strategic way? And so that to me, even though the title hasn't been there, the work has been there for the past 10 years. So I don't feel like I'm stumbling into it unprepared or underprepared. It's simply a title. And I know this, I think this is something that I just like need to figure out as well, is just how do I hold that title with the authority it has. But again, like I'm just such a coordinator at heart. I'm like, sure, your perspective is just as valuable as mine as a head of success, but people are like, it's not. I'm like, okay, cool, I'll get used to that.
Yeah,
but
is there something new you've learned about yourself now being a couple months into this new job?
I think that it's, and again, I think this is to the credit of the culture of this organization, but also to the leadership team that we do have. But I think this role in this team, in this space, has really given me the room to really see the best of myself. You know, and I think what I've learned about myself is I feel confident that I can outlearn most people. My capacity and ability to learn really quickly and like a wide breadth of information and make decisions. I feel very confident about that in myself, and that ability to adapt and learn. I think I've learned a lot about just the weight of my voice. I don't think I've ever felt as valued in terms of like the ideas that I bring to the table, but also just how much, you know, giving someone that space can continue to accelerate that their confidence and their ability to do that. So like having felt that from my leaders, I feel very much empowered or inspired to do that for the teams that I have, is how do I create the space for folks to share their voice and to hear themselves and settle into that space and feel confident in that space and then continue to bring their voice afterwards. I think that's something that I've learned. I have the space to create and do, and the responsibility that I hold to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Is there a self-doubt that you are either one from the past that's, you know, still moves forward with you no matter where you go, or a new one that's emerged doing this job now?
constantly a doubt. I think I live with, and like, good gracious, I hope I squash this in the next few years, months, weeks, is imposter syndrome. Like, there's never a time when I feel fully equipped to do this job. But everyone's like, stop with the imposter syndrome. But like, it makes me hustle. It makes me learn more. It forces me to be around people that I aspire to be. It also helps me understand or like articulate, as I have these conversations, what do I need? I had a great conversation with a friend last week who's well connected and can connect me with other heads of success in other industries. And he asked me the other day, he's like, I really want to help you. How can I help you? And I couldn't articulate that. And so, you know, I think it's this imposter syndrome to me is important because it keeps you humble. It keeps you learning. It keeps you aspiring for more. But I think as long as you have an ability or like the confidence and the courage to say, these are the things that I need, that imposter syndrome to a point of like inability to act stays at bay. I don't know. I think there is a space for it as long as there's like that constant, you know, one foot in front of the other, you know, keep moving forward, keep showing up, keep doing your best. Because I never want to feel overconfident in a role.
Totally. I completely agree with you. So I don't always agree. What I like what you said there is I don't always agree with this rhetoric sometimes that's out there around imposter syndrome to squash it. Here's a way to eliminate it. Here's a way to get rid of it. Because to your point, it's actually really helpful. It's a helpful activator to have constant self-doubt and self-critique. Because then you're like, I need to learn more. I need to hustle more. It helps you action and do good work. But I think the key thing you said there is where it gets debilitating is where the problem comes in. So yeah, to your point, like, how do I keep that at bay? Right. And asking for help is one way to do that, but also ask for that damn notebook. You know,
I got a notebook. I didn't buy it from Shoppers. I got my own.
Get that pen.
Expensed.
Brand. Too good to go. Branded notebook is what you need. That's the lesson here, people. Ask for that notebook, you know? All right, Cece, your career is super fascinating, so interesting. And I love the way you get real. You get to the heart of a lot of the emotional pieces, I think, that come with moving through your career, which is the whole point as to why I want to do this podcast in the first place. Mm-hmm. But sort of nearing the end here, I want to ask you a couple of conclusion questions. So one is, and we've talked about this a lot, but what's always been true about the way you've made choices in your career for yourself that will continue to be true, you think?
Yeah. So I've always asked for three things when it comes to looking at if I should stay at a role or if I should move somewhere else. Is one, do I believe in the impact of the organization, the greater work that I'm doing? Do I genuinely believe in the impact is good? Two, do I believe that the skills that I offer right now are the best skills to be able to make, to continue to move that work forward? And number three, am I learning and growing the ways that I want to be growing with this organization? Are they contributing to my growth? And if those three things are answered in a way that sits with me at that time, I'm happy to stay. I'm happy to go. I'm happy to move on to something else that answers those three questions better. But for me, those have always been the three guiding questions of whether or not I stay or whether or not I go.
I think those are great. That's a very practical way to make choices.
Love a good framework. Love a good bucketed, you know.
Bucket. It's always that
three buckets,
trifecta framework that tends to work.
Yeah.
What have you been the most proud of?
I'm most proud of my resilience right now, but I think I want to learn to really be proud of, or get to a place where I'm really proud of, nope, I want to sit comfortably being proud of the space that I take up, the ideas I bring to the table, and the voice that I bring, and the perspectives that I bring. I think I still am learning to hear myself and like my voice in a room. I'm still learning to sit comfortably with that. Like, there's nothing more painful that someone can do to me than make me watch myself on video. That's the hardest, most painful thing someone can make me do.
How are you going to feel listening to yourself on audio then?
I probably won't listen to this afterwards. As an aside, I had to film but a 45 second video for a video that was going out to the global organization. It took us 3 hours to film it because I really don't like the sound of my voice being on camera in like holding space.
That's fair. You'll get there. I mean, you kind of have to listen to this episode. Otherwise our friendship is over.
Noted.
You said this a lot, but just a summation, what are you continuing to work on?
I think what I want to continue working on is how I share my experience and learning with others, and how I create spaces for others to learn from one another. I think I'm a really good facilitator generally when I'm like wearing facilitator hat, but how do I create that on an ongoing basis? But particularly like sharing my experiences and skills, I think I've just acquired a lot over time. And so in my mind, it's like, well, doesn't everyone know how to do a pivot table on Excel? Why don't you know how to build, to do effective sales calls? And in my mind, those are just like, everyone knows how to do it. I don't really think about the skills that I've acquired over time and that not everyone has them. So I think getting comfortable with sharing my skills and my lessons and what I've learned throughout my life, and seeing that as a value add to other people.
I mean, that's a good point. You do forget when you've been in the game a long time, what it feels like to be new or starting to acquire that arsenal of skill set for sure. Yeah, that's a good point. When you're not doing your day job as head of excess, what are some of your favorite things to do? Just bullet points.
Are you saying head of excess?
I said success. Success.
That's the second time. When I'm not doing this. So, you know this about me, I am a serial learner. There is never a time that I'm not learning a new skill or taking up a new sport or taking up a new hobby. Like last summer, I learned how to build houses. Just because I think it's important to always be in like a newbie mindset and like, you know, don't get that ego, you know, keep that ego in check, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
And nothing humbles you like being shit at something.
Oh, don't I know it. Oh my God.
Being terrible at a sport when everyone else is proficient keeps you humble. So always doing that. Really, it's summertime, so like big into cycling and spin, and being outside as much as possible. But
and don't forget dim sum.
Love my food.
Love the food. Love the dim sum. Yeah, absolutely. I love you talk about always keeping that beginner's learning mentality to keep you humble. That's actually so true. When I suck at something and everyone else is great, it's like, oh yeah, I'm not the shit. Good to know. If you had a choice to do your career over again in another lifetime, what would you want to be?
This is so cheesy, but I'm actually so happy where I am. Like, I don't even think if it's like, if you could do your career over again, but if like money was no object, you know, I think that's a different question. So I don't know if that you want that answer, but
it's okay. You can change the question.
Okay. The question is, if money was no object, I think I would be a, I'd like to run a small community garden. I was going to say a farmer, but like being a farmer is actually hard work.
That's really hard. Yeah. So you just want to run a
family of like actual farmers, and that is hard work. That is backbreaking work.
I think you just want to
have you cut sugar cane? There are thorns.
No. What I think what you want is a manageable community garden.
I want a community garden where people can come and like learn to garden and grow their own fruits and vegetables, understand where food comes from, you know, connect with other community members.
Yeah.
Make a maker space, make beautiful things.
You know what's interesting is I've interviewed 4 people so far, and every time I ask this question, it's always a garden. Always. Every time.
Every Cultivate time. Your own garden, you know?
People want to make their own food. That's a saying. It's true. Okay.
Voltaire said it. So it's
Voltaire. Thank you, Voltaire. Thank you. And the last 2 questions, and these questions are the whole reason why I wanted to do this podcast. So one is, you talk about this as a mentor. For people just trying to figure out their career, whether it is they want to make a change, they want to leap, they want a promotion, they feel stuck, whatever. Mm-hmm. What learning do you share with others?
I would say be clear on how you want to be challenged and how you want to grow. Be clear with yourself on what that means. I think oftentimes people are chasing more money or chasing a new title or chasing a promotion, but growth doesn't always have to come with that type of change. Some of the greatest growth I've done was within a role or a lateral move. So be clear with yourself on what needs to change for you to be happy. Chances are as well, sometimes it isn't from work. Sometimes it's stuff outside of your life as well. So be clear with yourself as to what change you want to see for yourself.
Totally. I had an interview with Peter last time, and he had very similar advice. Mm. But if I could add to what you said, his was, not just have a way you want to learn and be challenged, but like, what do you want your work to mean for you? For him, it was, I want to be doing fun and innovative work. And it just allows you more flexibility. So it doesn't tie you to a title or tie you to a specific organization. Right. It's like, as long as what I'm doing gives me the breadth and the scope to be fun and innovative, then I'm happy.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just more agile. It's more agile way of thinking about progress. So I'm glad you brought that up again, because that's come up a couple times as like a really strong insight from people.
Cool.
And also, these are people who chase titles, man. Like, we're not ashamed to say we've chased some titles, you know.
Have I asked for that associate to be dropped before? Yes. Have I asked for that senior? Absolutely.
Drop the associate, add the senior.
But is the work any different? No.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
I'm going to have you back because we're going to talk about pay equity and ask advocating for pay, because I think that's a whole other
beast. That's a story for another time.
That's a story for another time. Okay, last question here and then we'll wrap up. But what is it about what you do that gives you purpose and meaning today in one sentence?
People got to stop asking for one sentence things.
It's to keep concise.
Semicolons. Let me put a dash in there.
All right. Do you, boo.
Say the question again.
What is it about? What is about what you do today that gives you purpose and meaning?
Is that, to me, what life is about is seeing the breadth of humanity. And my job is to listen to as many people as possible. And so that gives me life, because it means that through this listening, I build solutions that make people walk through or help people walk through life a little bit lighter.
Beautiful. I see you added your own semicolon in there.
It was semicolon, dash, dash.
Exclamation.
Exclamation, colon, dash, dash.
No one can put CC in a box.
No.
Don't put baby in the corner. Okay. Thanks so much, Zee. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you did too. Being your best friend for years, I've actually learned a lot a lot about you in this, which is why I love it. And I feel like people are getting a fly on the wall experience to what our phone conversations sound like. This is really sometimes how deep we go, truly.
Constant. Or on a voice note.
Or on a, you know, a solid voice note.
That holds a lot.
It holds a lot. It's so good. All right. See, if someone wanted to connect with you and not just learn more about your job at Head of Success or Too Good to Go or just your career in generally, how can people find you? What's the best way to reach you?
Through the bat signal. Look to the sky. Just
kidding. You just see a giant C.
Find me on LinkedIn. My name is so long though, like Cecilia, C-E-C-I-L-I-A, Chrysostomo. Look for the long one. C-R-I-S-O-S-T-O. M as in Mary. Oh, I don't know if you want me to spell this out or not. It's so long.
No, that was good. Or people, you can find her through me on LinkedIn. My name's shorter. Okay, Cecilia Chrysostomo on LinkedIn is the best
way to still can't say my last
name. Chrysostomo!
You put two T. There's just one. It's one T, two S's, just an O at the end.
Chrysostomo. I'll get it one day.
Oh, God.
And if they were to actually message you on LinkedIn, what do you prefer people to say? Like what's actually going to get your attention?
Probably just to say exactly what you're looking for from me. I think I've gotten a lot of questions about one thing, but you're really asking me about a job or a certain experience. Just ask me directly what you're looking for. I'm always willing to have a conversation with anyone. 30 minutes is not a hard thing to give up. So
great. Yeah. That's actually a tactic, people. When you're asking someone for their time, be direct and be clear and honest about what it is you want to get out of the conversation. It helps the person on the other side know how to walk in. And if people were interested into the Too Good to Go movement, because I know you guys are big in Toronto, doing some great work, looking to expand in Vancouver, which is super, super exciting. How can people follow the movement, get involved?
Yes. So number one, download the app on Apple Play Store or Apple App Store or Google Play Store. It's Too Good to Go. Follow us on Instagram, toogoodtogo.can for us in Canada. Or ask me about it.
Great. All right. Thank you everyone so much for tuning in. You can find the episode with Cecilia on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. And we want to thank Cece so much for her time today. Until next time.